This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
Across Wisconsin from Civic Media, this is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
With just a little glint of the rising sun out on the eastern sky, good morning. Welcome back to Up North News Radio, unabashedly Wisconsin, brought to you by Courier Newsroom and carried by our friends on the Civic Media Radio Network. It is 7:06 on this Monday morning, January 6, 2025. Nice to have you along. Coming up in our second half hour, we are going to be talking with UW Green Bay Professor John Shelton. John is also chair of Democracy and Justice Studies at UWGB and recently wrote an article in The Nation magazine about how Democrats need to make a big change to their year-round messaging if they want to win back blue-collar voters. It's very much in keeping with what we've been saying here in terms of the need for there to be messaging and organizing and media work done year round and not just parachuting in at election time. So we'll talk to John Shelton about that coming up. Elizabeth Montemurro is here as well, and we will be talking in just a few moments about Governor Tony Evers setting up a bold new proposal for changing the way that the Wisconsin Constitution can be amended. Brittany Merlot is off this morning, so we'll tell you that temperatures around Civic Media land go like this. It's 6 degrees right now in Chippewa Falls. Hayward has dropped to 3 below. Amory's at 1 below. Wausau's at 12 right now. La Crosse, 8 degrees. Wisconsin Rapids, 11. Green Bay is at 24 right now. Madison and Waukesha both reporting 19 degrees. And in Radio Park and Racine, it is 25 degrees right now here on this January 6th, which is not only the fourth anniversary of the insurrection in Washington, D.C., but the fifth anniversary of Up North News, which first went live on January 6th, 2020, when the world looked a lot different because even in that first week, there were just these rumblings about some kind of virus in China starting to spread beyond the borders, and we were trying to learn what COVID meant. What was this COVID-19 thing? And of course, we know how the rest of 2020 went, and then into 2021 with the insurrection and all the many stories that we have followed ever since. And one of the consistencies of these past 5 years has been Tony Evers in the governor's office, winning a second term back in 2022, but in all 5 years dealing with a Republican-led legislature. As a result, you have a legislature that has been great at picking fights with the governor, not so great in terms of being engaged in the kinds of things that, you know, maybe Wisconsin citizens would like to see their legislature work on. And so the governor has seen enough of that. They've seen enough of him ignoring his calls for special sessions to work on the state's biggest problems. And so Up North News political reporter Elizabeth Montemurro joins us now to tell us more about what Governor Evers is proposing. Elizabeth, good morning again. This started with the governor announcing that he was going to be briefing folks in the media about the plans. You were among the attendees there, and we did not know at the time what he was going to be unveiling. So why don't you tell us a bit more about how things began? I'm sure it was dealing with the fact that a new session of the Wisconsin legislature kicks off today.
That's right. The new session does start today. And, you know, the governor opened his remarks really with a bit of optimism. He's spoken about this previously, but with Wisconsinites voting under new maps this past fall, That definitely changed the makeup of the state legislature. So he's definitely feeling a little bit of optimism about that. If not, hopefully some collaboration.
Okay, let's give a listen to what the governor had to say about his optimism for the new session.
I've already seen an opportunity for some of the new people on the Democratic side reaching out and talking to individuals on the Republican side about issues. That just didn't happen in the past. There's certainly opportunities for us to get along better and to accomplish things for the people of Wisconsin. And that's what fair maps are all about. When I ran for this office, I said, we have to have fair maps, not gerrymandered Democrat maps. And that's exactly what we have. And the reason I believe so strongly about that is that the will of the people is the law of the land. And we're a purple state. And the maps reflect that. And I think as a result of that, we will see more collaboration.
Well, that's the goal anyway, Elizabeth. And look, it's one thing to say you want collaboration. It's another for the leadership in the other party to go along. To go along with it. And that's leadership versus, you know, the rank and file members, rank and file Republicans. Some of them might feel like, yeah, we could be more collaborative. But, you know, leadership has been saying a different thing. But if in fact there is greater collaboration, where might we see that in terms of what the governor is thinking?
Excuse me.
That's okay. It's winter. It's very dry out there. We're okay. So what was the governor saying about the need? What areas do we need to see more collaboration?
We definitely need to, and he seemed hopeful that there will be continued progress in areas like childcare, affordable housing, mental health, and gun safety. He's definitely added that last part in, considering that we just unfortunately had another school shooting right before Christmas.
Yeah, and we should note that he has called a special session in the past over gun safety, and he has called special sessions in the past about some of these other areas that are such high profile problems, and there is such bipartisan support for addressing the problems that he has called special sessions of the legislature, all of which have essentially been ignored by Republicans. And then the other thing Republicans have ignored has been basically anything Governor Evers put in his budget bill. The way it's supposed to work is the governor writes a budget bill, sends it on to the legislature, and then they say, well, we'll keep these things in, we'll tweak these things, we'll drop these things. And they do it entirely different. The Republicans just put the whole thing in the trash and start over. But that doesn't stop the governor from still proposing things in a budget. And that's where we're getting to next in terms of what all is going to be in his budget bill proposal.
Exactly. We definitely, I think, can see, like I said, that childcare component, affordable housing, and continued efforts to prioritize mental health and education. But like you said, Pat, because Republicans in the state legislature have continued to do this gavel in, gavel out, and not really look at or even consider these initiatives or items that the governor has called special sessions for, that he really leads us to the governor's announcement today that he's adding in a piece and has announced that he's adding in this piece to his budget that's not necessarily budget related, but would enshrine a pathway for the will of the people to be the law of the land.
I'm hopeful that as we ring in a new year in Wisconsin after fair maps, we will see a legislature that's more collaborative, more responsive, and reflects the will of the people of the state. So today I'm announcing, a provision I'll be including in the biennial budget to require the legislature to give the people of Wisconsin a pathway to enshrine the will of the people. It's no secret that since I took office, Republican legislators have repeatedly ignored the will of the people of Wisconsin, a majority of whom support proposals like restoring Roe legalizing and taxing marijuana, among many other issues. Republican lawmakers shouldn't be able to ignore the will of the people and then prevent the people from having a voice when their legislators fail to listen.
And so across the country, Elizabeth, how prevalent is this where at the state level citizens can propose and vote on constitutional amendments?
About half of the states in the U.S. have a similar measure where citizens can bring a ballot initiative or a binding referenda, including some of our neighboring states like Michigan and Illinois. But, you know, Wisconsin voters don't have that option right now. Those initiatives that we think we vote on, or we, you know, in the last couple elections, we've had those constitutional amendments that we're voting on. And if we are seeing anything on the ballot, it's non-binding. So it really doesn't have any teeth to it.
Right. And when something is on there, again, it's almost completely within, you know, Republican Party thinking about things like voting and lifting, you know, or putting in place potential barriers toward voting rights and things like that. So as the governor says, if Republicans can legislate through constitutional amendments, the people should be able to as well. And so that's a proposal that will be in his budget bill. Although, Elizabeth, we do know that Republicans, they love to say that they take non-fiscal items out of the budget bill. So it seems a pretty good guess that they're going to want to do the same for this once they get the governor's budget bill proposal.
You're right. It is pretty likely to happen. But given how the legislature has operated in the past and the governor's relationship with certain members in the state legislature, it's no surprise that he would take this tactic, at least, to try and get something put forward, since when he has tried to call a special session, there's been no progress or even debate whatsoever. It's just been a gavel in, gavel out.
And that's where the fair maps come back into play here, because again, you have much smaller Republican majorities. And so in the past, it was very easy to ignore special session requests. Even if a handful of Republicans wanted to do something on an issue, it really didn't matter. Whereas now, when it comes to amending the state constitution, I'm sure part of the thinking of the governor's team is that there are going to be some Republican legislators who are either going to feel the pressure to do this or want to do it and say, yeah, the people ought to have an ability to vote on what should be and propose what should be constitutional amendments here in Wisconsin. Will that happen? Of course, is anybody's guess, but with a smaller Republican majority, that may increase the odds that we see initiative and referendum take place here in Wisconsin. We're going to pause for a moment, and when we come back, we're going to ask Elizabeth Montemurro what else Governor Evers had to say in his press briefing, especially with the incoming Trump administration as well. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Up North News Radio, live from Lake Wissota on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
We mentioned in today's history lesson that Alex Turner, frontman and primary songwriter of Arctic Monkeys, turns 39 years old today. You can catch our history lesson every weekday morning at 6:50 here on Up North News Radio. You can also sign up for our Unabashedly Wisconsin newsletter. It comes out every weekday morning. Click subscribe at the top of our homepage, upnorthnewswi.com. In the newsletter today, my article on our fifth anniversary at Up North News, 4 years since the Capitol insurrection, and the $4 billion question in Madison on whether Republican legislators might actually try to get a win-win budget working with Governor Evers. Can they split $4 billion amongst themselves and make everybody happy? Or will they once again just seek division and to try to get their way at all possible costs? Governor Evers is certainly preparing for that budget session with that big proposal we discussed just a moment ago with Up North News political correspondent Elizabeth Montemurro. That would provide a path for citizens to be able to propose and vote on constitutional amendments. So that was a big part of the governor's recent press briefing. But Elizabeth, what else did the governor have to say, especially with a second Trump administration kicking off 2 weeks from today?
You know, one big item that the governor received questions on was how he would plan to work with the incoming Trump administration on some hot topic issues that we've talked about before, like immigration. In Wisconsin, we rely on a lot of migrant workers, particularly to help on our farms. And that was definitely a hot topic of conversation.
The bottom line is, you know, in Wisconsin, 70% of our farms are dealing with 70% of the people that may be part of the federal government's idea to move them elsewhere. Think about that. How in the hell would we continue to be the dairy state when there's nobody there to milk the cows and do the other important work?
And we're just going to say it again and again until folks, you know, get it, that roughly 80% of the labor involved in the dairy industry comes from undocumented immigrants. And that's not the way that people would necessarily want it to be, but there are agricultural visas for harvesting crops, but there are no agricultural visas for year-round dairy. You know, you harvest a crop once, maybe twice a year, cows got to get milked every single day. And yet year after year, there's been no progress on an agricultural visa for migrant labor. And so if you do these mass deportations, like the governor is saying, he says, how in the hell would we continue to be the dairy state? Elizabeth, any other impressions from what all the governor talked about with your trip out to Madison?
I think overall optimism and a little bit of wait and see, particularly in relation or when it comes to how the governor is going to have to work with the incoming Trump administration. You know, he said we can only guess as to what can happen, but it's a little bit of a mixed bag because we've heard things, but he's done other. The Trump has done the exact opposite in the past, so. Right. A little bit of wait and see.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we'll face, I would say, especially in the first week of the administration coming up 2 weeks from today, where states like Wisconsin may have to react quickly to some of the things coming from the new administration. Up North News political correspondent Elizabeth Montemurro, thanks so much for joining us. Selena will be back next Monday. We'll hear from her Wednesday of this week. Elizabeth, have a great day. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks. You too.
You bet. Now, in terms of, you know, something that the governor said about basically people, you know, when are they going to understand how these things work, and how do you work with people that don't understand how farm labor works? And it reminds me of another, the latest in manufactured controversies from the right. Remember I think we were supposed to, all the things we were supposed to boycott. We're supposed to boycott Bud Light. We're supposed to boycott M&Ms. We're supposed to boycott anything that embraced diversity, equity, and inclusion. Well, now you can add Allstate to the list of things that you're supposed to be angry about, because the CEO of Allstate had the audacity to ask this nation to come together after the tragedy in New Orleans, the New Year's Day terror attack of, by the way, an American-born American citizen who served in the military, not an undocumented immigrant responsible for the New Orleans attack, an American veteran who was. But let's get past the misinformation and take you to how that attack led to the one-day postponement, one-day delay of the Sugar Bowl being played in New Orleans. And during a commercial for that game, the CEO of Allstate made some comments wanting to honor the victims. And he said, you know, Wednesday tragedy struck the New Orleans community. Our prayers are with the victims and their families. He also said this: we also need to be stronger together by overcoming an addiction to divisiveness and negativity. Join Allstate, working in local communities all across America to amplify the positive, increase the trust, and accept people's imperfections and differences. Together we win. Let me read that again. And tell me, if you're a Donald Trump supporter, where are you offended by what I'm about to repeat here? We also need to be stronger together by overcoming an addiction to divisiveness and negativity. Join Allstate, working in local communities all across America to amplify the positive, increase trust, and accept people's imperfections and differences. Together, we win. Well, the MAGA world lost its mind from Elon Musk on down. You had everybody saying that Allstate now has to be boycotted because this Allstate CEO is lecturing us on negativity and divisiveness. Folks, if that's what you heard, again, you should not be looking at the Allstate CEO for condemnation. You should be looking in a mirror, because everything that he said, every word that he spoke, was the gospel truth of what this country needs. Is we need a certain political class in this country to stop fighting everything negatively and to work together with one another and to stop turning everything into hate and the need to boycott. But that's apparently the latest thing now, along with your Bud Light and your M&Ms and everything else. We'll hear from John Shelton after this.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
Back now on Up North News Radio, 7:34 this morning, and a little bit of post-election talk, but don't turn away. This isn't going to be the usual navel gazing of, you know, what did Kamala Harris do wrong or something like that. We're trying to be productive, forward looking, because the fact of the matter is there are more Americans who share progressive values when you talk to them on an issue by issue basis. But the Democratic brand is not faring as well in elections. John Shelton is one of the people who's been looking into this. He's professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He is also president of the faculty and staff union at UWGB. And he has teamed up with Neil Cross for an article in The Nation magazine entitled "Why Democrats Are Losing Americans Without a College Degree and How to Win Them Back." And the how to win them back is what should be getting the proper amount of attention. John Shelton, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thanks for having me, Pat, and Happy New Year to everybody.
You as well. Good to talk to you again. We spoke just about a year ago about labor issues overwhelmingly, and I'm sure we'll still get to that as part of the solution here. But look, let's not drag it out too far with folks. Let's not tease them for, you know, a full 15 minutes here. That second part of the headline, how to win back Americans without a college degree. In a nutshell, what are you saying is the best course of action ahead for progressives and for the Democratic Party?
Yeah, well, let's start with one thing, Pat. And you know, I think I'm a historian, right? So, you know, you mentioned navel gazing. One of the things that we do is we, you know, in kind of the contemporary political landscape, is we look at an election in a vacuum, right? We kind of think about all the unique things that are happening, and it's not that we shouldn't do that. But let's, instead of just looking at this election, let's look at the last three. and the last three presidential elections. And what's happened in each of those presidential elections is that the effective incumbent basically lost, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton was the effective incumbent in 2016. Trump, of course, was the real incumbent in 2020. And then Kamala Harris was effectively the incumbent in 2024. And in each case, that person lost by, you know, relatively small margins in the context of American presidential elections. So what does that tell us? Well, you know, it doesn't tell us that Trump has like, and the current iteration of the Republican Party have like magically realigned things around Trumpism and racism and xenophobia and all the stuff that we know is a part of what Trump stands for. What it tells you is that Americans, particularly the like, you know, 8 to 10 million Americans that actually swing elections, right, that are up for grabs, either, you know, going one way or another, or, you know, getting them to turn out to vote, they desperately want things to change in this country. They desperately want a set of economic rights that provide security for them. And they're not getting it. They just haven't been getting it from Democrats. They're certainly not going to get it from Republicans. And while Democrats have been better, and frankly, you know, I think there's a good case that Biden was the best president we've had in this country since at least the 1960s, maybe since Truman in the 1940s. Not enough Americans knew about it, and certainly couldn't see the big economic, agenda of the Biden-Harris administration as something that was benefiting them. And so the good news is, you know, looking ahead to 2026 and 2028, we have the opportunity to remake American politics along those lines, but Democrats, as Neil and I argue in the piece, they have to foreground economic issues. And I don't mean like, you know, small potatoes kind of things. I mean big economic security issues like the right to a job, like universal health care, like the right to good housing. And if we can do these things, then we can realign American politics as, you know, FDR did in, say, the 1930s.
The way that you wrote it in the article, it said what Democrats must do is to offer a big transformative vision and stick to it for as long as it takes to actualize it. Democrats must craft a vision of economic rights that tells the story of how we got here and what we need to do. And you also make clear, in my interpretation of it, that Democrats, when you say, must clearly commit to a vision and a narrative that prioritizes meaningful economic security for working people. What I'm getting out of this is it can't be just about what's your winning message during election season. That this has to be, when you say a narrative and a vision, this is 7 days a week, 365 days a year, the point you're making over and over again, that it's not just the message, but frankly, it's the medium as well. We talk all the time about the need for a media ecosystem, you know, that is nowhere near as competitive as the right-wing ecosystem right now. But my larger point to you is year-round organizing and messaging and media and not all of this one-off election year stuff.
Yeah, no, that's right. And you know, I think the Republicans have done this quite effectively for a long time, right? I mean, if we talk about what it is that the Republican Party stands for going back 30, 40, 50 years, we could pretty clearly say that their narrative is, well, you know, you've got too much government, too much taxes, and, you know, we have people being divided and we have different racial groups that are, you know, coming and taking your jobs, right? I mean, what is a narrative has clear heroes and villains, and the Republican version has had that for quite some time. Democrats, I think, go back to the 1930s, you know, as Neil and I wrote in the piece, you know, you've got a mill worker writing in to the White House basically saying FDR is the first man in the, summarizing here, the first man in the White House who understands that my boss is a son of a B-word, right? Mm-hmm. And that was the ethos of the 1930s, that, you know, it was to use the term of FDR, the economic royalists that had caused the Depression, that had taken the economic rights away from working people. And Democrats haven't had that for such a long period of time, right? I mean, you know, you have both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris saying, yeah, well, I'm a capitalist. Well, you know, if you're a working person, that's not exactly what you want to hear. I mean, most workers don't consider themselves to be capitalists, right? They obviously see themselves in a capitalist system potentially, but like they don't see themselves as a capitalist. And I think Democrats for too long have tried to have this middle ground where they try to accommodate corporations and corporate leaders, and then also at the same time talk about how they're going to help workers. And you know, there's a classic saying that goes back to a song written by during a United Mine Workers strike in the 1930s. Which side are you on? And you know, working people need to see that Democrats are on their side and fighting with them to change things and to create the sort of economic system that we all deserve. And there's been steps in the right direction. I mean, Joe Biden going on picket lines, big example. A good example of that, but we need more of that. And as you sort of intimated, we need to be doing that consistently over and over and over again until we make, you know, big changes, because the Republicans will never actually deliver anything to working people. They won't.
No, they haven't. They won't. But they'll always find a villain. And Democrats have not been doing the same, you know, for a host of reasons like you outline. And of course, there's all the money in politics as well.
And by the way, Elon Musk is a great villain, isn't he? I mean,
yes. I mean, for so many reasons on so many different levels. And yet not nearly enough is being done on that front, I would argue, to this point. There's been a lot written about the election and where Democrats need to go. Politico had a piece that said new research shows the massive hole Dems are in, and part of what I pulled out of it was being seen as insincere or disingenuous. And focus group participants said, well, in one case, an Arizona man said that when Harris said you'd better thank a union member, he said it sounded disingenuous to him and you know, inauthentic. And yet you argue in your piece that there is most definitely a role for unions and for labor to play going forward. Are you saying that Democrats, while they clearly share the same values, haven't forged the right partnership with labor?
Well, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, I'm a union leader. Neil and I are both union leaders. And, you know, I think... Look, we're reflecting right now on the death of Jimmy Carter, who was, I'm going to be putting out a piece about this soon, but, you know, Carter was a great man. He was moral. He did a lot of good things in the White House, including, you know, potentially getting us closer on a path toward peace in the Middle East than anybody else. The Panama Canal Treaty was, a very... a good way to rectify the history of American imperialism in Latin America. There are very good things that happened. But one of Carter's biggest failures, if we're being honest about it, is the failure to actually commit to getting labor law reform in his term in office. And I just want to remind people that, you know, when Carter came into office in 77, he had huge Democratic majorities, right? I mean, I don't think there have been Democratic majorities that were that big since. I don't know off the top of my head, but in any case, like, that's as big as they've been in the past, like, half century. And Carter did not put much effort into labor law reform, and it was badly needed, right? I mean, at the time, we had about 23-24% union density. Now we're down to about 11. And in the 1970s, employers were increasingly going after unions and making it difficult for working people to win bargaining elections, and then just flat out refusing to bargain. Labor law reform would have changed that. And that was just like the first in a series of Democratic presidents failing to deliver.
Well, I was going to say, if you fast forward 30 years, I recall that one of the forks in the road for President Obama, yep, was that he felt like he couldn't do both the Affordable Care Act and the Employee Free Choice Act. And he had to pick one or the other, and he pursued health care. But again, a big opportunity was missed to show working Americans, especially the ones who don't yet belong to unions, who was really on their side. So, I mean, your point is well taken, not just from Jimmy Carter, but as you were about to say, on through the years.
Clinton failed to pass striker replacement law, which is what the AFL-CIO wanted. Obama failed to pass card check legislation. And then the PRO Act, which was, you know, better than all of those bills, by the way. It's the best labor reform bill we've had since the 1970s, maybe even better than that, you know, stalled because of, a few Democrats in the Senate who didn't want to do it. And, you know, I think that the problem is you want to see the president put more pressure on those people and make that a priority. not just because it's good for Americans, although it is. I mean, unions poll at about 75% approval right now, which is their highest rating since public approval rating since the 1960s. In fact, almost half of Republicans even support labor unions in this country. So it's good for people, and so there's a huge disconnect when you have that much support, but only 11% of workers covered by collectively bargained contracts in this country. But it's also good for Democrats, because corporate America is always going to side, the majority of them, they're always going to side with Republicans. The only way that Democrats can truly counteract that is by having a strong labor movement that's you know, going to go to the mat and back up Democratic politicians. That's what FDR realized in the 1930s. That's what Truman realized in the 1940s. That's what Johnson realized in the 1960s. And so, you know, that Democrats, it's absolutely imperative that they understand that, from people running for president all the way down to people running for, you know, state assembly and city council seats.
Well, let me take it then and close with a paragraph from your article that I think really spells this out. And you write, economic inequality and insecurity are typically framed in terms of inflation. And it's true, the cost of nearly everything skyrocketed during COVID and never came down, despite inflation coming down to normal levels well over a year before the election. But inflation is largely a problem because so many workers have so few mechanisms like collective bargaining to ensure that they can keep or purchase a larger slice of what the economy produces. In short, John, and in conclusion, we have to recognize that so many people, whatever their income level, they have economic insecurity, but there needs to be a better message of what is really the cause of that and who is truly fighting to alleviate that.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's corporations that are raising prices, and it's corporations that are preventing workers from collective bargaining and raising their wages. And so who's going to counteract that? It's got to be us. It's got to be the labor movement. And we need Democrats to be fully on board with that.
The article in The Nation is called Why Democrats Are Losing Americans Without a College Degree and How to Win Them Back. Look it up. John Shelton and Neil Krause put that together. John Shelton is professor and chair of Democracy and Justice Studies at UW Green Bay. John, great to connect with you again. Happy New Year. And let's visit again real soon.
Absolutely. Always fun talking to you, Pat. Take care.
All right. We'll wrap up things here on Up North News Radio after this on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
You know, this is how it's the start of everybody else's day. It's the end of my radio show. This is how I want to end a day that we're marking our fifth anniversary at Up North News, but also noting some bad things that happened 4 years ago today, but handing it off to the very capable, the very wonderful Jane Matinere, who's going to take folks through other things to remember about this January 6th. Jane, good morning. How are you?
I am fine, Pat. Thank you so much. I saw your newsletter when I got up this morning, and I had no idea that you guys launched the year before on January 6th.
Yes, yeah, and we were very proud of that. You know, we could have made up some other date, but we're like, no, yeah, that's when we actually did this puppy, and so, you know, let's own it and say, okay, let's recommit ourselves to what's got to get done to protect our democracy. I know that as I'm looking at the rundown of some of the other civic media shows today, you know, Maggie Dawn's going to have some sound from that day. She's also got, she's calling out people like Tim Cook from Apple for giving $1 million to Trump's inauguration, even as the guy's going to be sentenced this Friday. Between this and everything we just heard from John Shelton, there's just never been a more important time for voices like yours and everybody else across civic media on a day like today.
Absolutely. And I think, and we've talked about this on the show, but I think it's worth repeating, the news deserts have really had a major impact on how people process and get their news and what they are being fed. And civic media has only been around for 2.5 years. The other side has had 30 plus years to pretty much entrench themselves into their local media markets. And it's more important than ever, as you said, Pat, that we continue bringing facts to folks and bringing actual real information so they can make their own determinations. We're going to talk a little bit about the fourth anniversary of the attack on the U.S. Capitol. And I'm just looking forward to hearing from folks about what they remember, because I watched the entire day live as it was happening. And at several points, I thought, this is a movie. Yeah. This cannot be happening. This cannot be our country. And as you said, in the aftermath of some of this, Pat, to see Ron Johnson sit there and say, these people love their country. Mm-hmm. And to hear Donald Trump say, it was a day full of love. And I don't understand how people can square that.
They can't. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And we have to be thankful for all the little moments, like the one Capitol police officer who kind of, you know, faked out the crowd and had them chase him down one hallway instead of going the other, where there were members of Congress. There are those who have turned one of the mob, one member of the mob, Ashley Babbitt, I think was her name, into a hero.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The fact of the matter is, if law enforcement hadn't shot her down as the first one through that particular door or window that day,
yes,
again, God only knows what could have happened after that. She was no hero. The heroes were the ones that said, no, this actually requires deadly force right now, or this is going to get even worse.
And one of the things, too, that, you know, we've mentioned on Matt and Air on Air is the fact that, you know, the crew that is defending the actions of these traitors and these, you know, insurrectionists are the same ones who are also saying, back the blue. But the moment that the blue is defending the country against their group, they're terrible. And we won't do anything for them. And you ask, you know, did any police die? No police died that day. Well, that's semantics. Police did die as a result of that tragic event. Yeah. And it's disgusting to watch the hypocrisy.
Without a doubt. And so I'm glad that we're not seeding the day and saying, well, okay, well, you guys go ahead and turn this into some kind of a national day of celebration. No, not at all.
Well, not so far, because if Donald Trump does what he has said and he's going to pardon all these people, mm-hmm. I mean, Stuart Rhodes, the head of the Oath Keepers, is behind bars for a number of years. If he starts pardoning those people, to me, this implicitly gives the okay for others to act out violently in Donald Trump on Donald Trump's behalf.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and they will. And it could be argued they will anyway, but this only provides more gas to put on the fire. And let's make clear, Trump can pardon them, but he cannot pardon himself from state charges. He is rightfully a convicted felon. He is an adjudicated criminal who's going to be sworn in as president 2 weeks from today. He is scheduled to be sentenced this Friday. I don't know if an appeals court will delay that, but he is who he is, and nothing that he pronounces will make it otherwise. We all saw history. Speaking of watching history, you talk about watching it live that day. I'm wrapping up this book by George Stephanopoulos. It's basically it's a history of the Situation Room in the White House. And he finishes this long chapter on the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. And he talks about that famous photograph by Pete Souza of everybody gathered in this small room to watch it. Well, the story behind it is there is actually a bigger Situation Room, but the way the video feed was set up, they didn't think anybody else was going to want to watch it except some staff members would relay what they're seeing. So the feed was in this small room. And they said, move the feed to the big room so everybody can watch it. And the tech guy was like, I don't want to. I'm afraid that if I touch something, it will you know, screw up the feed. And so when people we heard on the YouTube from Tony saying, where's the old West pose? Why isn't Jane in the studio with Greg? Put Jane behind Greg. Like, no, we're not touching anything. The feed is working to Jane's little room. She is the little Situation Room right now, and we're touching nothing.
Don't touch the volume. Don't touch the connectors. No. Everything is working just fine. I can do this and pretend I'm standing behind Greg, which is what we usually do.
Perfect.
There you go. That's it. That's it. Clearly, I will work on my video editing skills and make you just hover above Greg. In
perfect. That would be great. Could you make me taller and thinner too when you do that? That would be wonderful.
I have to pay extra for that filter, but I'll give it a go. All right. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Greg.
We'll be back at 10 o'clock. And again, tomorrow we will have Congressman Mark Pocan in at 7:30. Up North News is part of Courier, a pro-democracy newsroom that is celebrating 5 years today. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Have a great day. We'll see you up north tomorrow morning.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.